This week on Decentralize, we're joined by core developer Jeff Garzik, the rise of fluid markets led by Uber, the increasing accessibility of hackable devices such as the Raspberry Pi, and the exploration of space, the final frontier.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Hello, Decentralized listeners, and welcome to episode 21 of Decentralized. We're excited to bring you another week of topics on decentralization and really cool developments in technology brought to you by some people really involved in kind of building these things, and we're really excited about all the things that are going on in the space. So we're also quite excited that we're at episode 21 now. Our podcast is old enough to drink. How are y'all feeling about that?
I'm drinking right now because of that.
Because of the torture that has gotten us to this point, or because it's a moment worth celebrating?
Both, actually. Definitely worth celebrating. So I got a glass here of some good Sam Smith cider, organic, of course. But it's good times, and I'm happy to be here for 21, and I'm happy to be here with you guys.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here, too, but I'm kind of mad at the podcast for being able to drink when I can't. Don't have laws? I mean, my gosh.
Now, what, you're in a private home. You're a private citizen in a private home. Who are you hurting, right?
I guess no one, but anyway, with that said, let's launch into some of the more serious topics this week. We don't want to hurt our listeners with our banter. So some interesting developments this week in kind of cool apps and cool developments of kind of the peer-to-peer principles that a lot of the most interesting technologies out there are running on. Obviously, Bitcoin is a peer-to-peer currency. Ride-sharing is sort of a basic implementation of that, but you're seeing an explosion of these kind of services which have been labeled by the technology media as Uber 4X services. So you know, obviously you have Uber for ride-sharing, but now we're seeing things for like Ubers for pet-sitting, and also more serious ones like Ubers for logistics, and that's what I want to talk about. There are a couple services here in Atlanta and throughout the Southeast called Roadie and Kinga, and they are essentially allowing people to ship and become shippers for products throughout this region, just peer-to-peer on an individual level. So if you have extra space in your car and someone wants to ship their piano or something, you can do that. And there have been really interesting results of this, and I'm wondering what y'all think of this. Do you think this is sort of another example of this sort of trend, this copycat trend of Uber going too far, or do you think this might actually have some interesting implications for how we kind of ship things around?
I definitely think that once Uber figures this out, that other companies are kind of doing their own thing, that Uber will crush them with their funding and their scale, that they will continue to pick up a lot of these side tasks that other companies are trying to do right now and pick them up themselves, a la Amazon. You know, they started out selling books. Look what they do now, everything. So I think that's the eventual end game here. So yes, it's a solid idea, but no, they're going to end up being beaten out by Uber or Lyft or whoever ends up being the supreme ride sharer of all of these. And it seems right now it's going to be Uber.
I'm much far less focused on, you know, transportation or even, you know, goods and services and looking at this from an overall trend perspective. And I think what we're seeing is the rollout of individual markets. Uber is an interesting case, Lyft too, of course, and it, because there is an actual impact on the consumer of the sort of flow, ebb and flow of supply and demand. You know, if there's a high demand for a service, the price goes up. If there's a low demand, the price goes down. And I think we're seeing this in a lot of places, right? Like, you can even fold this into Open Bazaar. You can fold this into a lot of the decentralized services that are emerging right now. And you're starting to see commercial ventures, entrepreneurs starting businesses that facilitate the creation of an efficient market through peer-to-peer interactions, whether they be, you know, sort of handheld in the case of Uber or much more decentralized in the case of things like Lazoos, another alternative to Uber. But I think in terms of a larger trend, we're actually starting to see a restoration of free markets, even if they're micro markets within individual verticals. I find that really interesting, and I think that may present a challenge, quite frankly, because consumers, especially here in the United States, this is less true in many other countries where haggling and sort of, you know, debate over the price before you actually buy something, whether it be your groceries, you know, you know, a couple eggs or some food for dinner. People actually haggle in many other places. But in the United States, with a consumer culture, everyone's sort of more familiar with just having one price for something. Maybe you don't even negotiate. You just go to another place if you want a different price. So I wonder if there's going to be some friction in the adoption of these types of technologies, just because, especially here in the Western world, people aren't used to this free market idea where you can negotiate or you can choose another service if the price of one person is too high, right?
I think you're right on track. We aren't really used to dealing directly with each other as peers, and that's kind of the genius of these services, is that they kind of introduce, they take away the friction, introduce the convenience and security we look for. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. And there's so many ways of looking at something like Roadie or something like Uber. I think Tony had great points in that, you know, Uber has this strong network effect. This is all about the network effect. But no matter what the technology is, something like this, it excites me as a way of saving the environment and like saving wealth and creating wealth. I mean, if you think about how much wealth goes into shipping, how much infrastructure spending is done, and how much cost and pollution is produced as a result of shipping at non-optimal levels. So when you're not really maximizing the use of capital we already have, like all the cars that are traveling on the roads, I think this is a great way of doing that. I mean, obviously, one of the phrases that's been tossed around a lot in sort of this, the intellectual exploration of peer-to-peer services is the resurrection of dead capital. And when you're driving your car to see your family in Virginia, you're using capital, but if you're also carrying a piano for a guy who wants to ship it and who's willing to pay you, everyone's winning from that. And that's amazing. It's really empowering. That is the entrepreneurship of this thing. It has so many applications, whether environmental or sort of economic in terms of impact. I do wonder, what are some of the services you are looking at and seeing as being successful, and what do you think drive them? Why do you think something like Uber has such a strong network effect? What are some services you think could actually challenge them?
So I think Uber, even like the reason this isn't even a conversation right now, is because Uber brought something to the transportation marketplace that was sort of dead, right? I mean, the transportation taxi industry, it was very stale. It wasn't innovating. There was large amounts of capital controls put in place. You purchase medallions. You have to get licensed by the state. And there's a lot of political games that get played. So innovation just sort of stopped in the taxi industry, which left this thing that I call an innovation gap, where when you come to the slow standstill, when there's too much regulation, it'll be a period of time, this gap, until someone swoops in and disrupts things completely, because the innovation, rather than being a smooth function, a smooth event over time, the market lurches to a halt, and someone swoops in to pick up the opportunity of the lost innovation that would have taken place otherwise. And why Uber is successful is that they made hailing a cab as easy as pressing a button on your damn phone. That's really the only reason that Uber, this is even a discussion right now. It's not as, you know, pretty as, you know, somebody wanted to bring a marketplace to transportation. No, they just wanted to figure out a way to, you know, okay, well, A, they had to avoid these, you know, regulations so that they could actually have the power to do this and not just be immediately shut down by the government and the cities and the states. And they just, you know, modernized it, and they built an app that you can ping drivers and they'll come pick you up. You know, we've got GPS built into our phones now. That wasn't even possible, you know, a decade ago. People barely carried cell phones not even 10 years ago, right? And it's just amazing to think that something as simple as, you know, modernizing something could bring about, you know, a multi-billion-dollar industry like this and cause so many political debates, right? It was just an app. And I think that's the essence of it. And I think people love the convenience of it, and they adopted it because it made, wow, for the first time, you know, something that should be easy is actually easy, and it's not awkward and difficult. And so people flock to it en masse, right? And that's why it achieved network effect, a very simple modernization of something that had an innovation gap.
And to follow up real quick on the one point of this, when the discussion started, it was as framed as Uber 4. As long as it's called Uber 4, that'll think the company's going to succeed because Uber's there. That's like saying it's Apple 4. Well, Apple's there. So I definitely wanted to circle back around to that, and I think, yeah, you know, it was an obvious, it's obvious in hindsight, like most great things are, but, you know, it is an app, and it works well, and, you know, I think it's crushing Lyft, so we'll see where it goes. I don't necessarily have the most faith in these startups, but I wish them nothing but the best, because new ideas are always good, so.
What's interesting to me about something like Roadie is that it's sort of unique, actually, and sort of a very fine point, but very interesting to me. It's unique among these peer-to-peer services in that they actually will employ sort of younger adults to do it. To be an Uber and Lyft driver, you do have to be above 21, also for drinking. but I am wondering, like, these services are primed to actually enable micro-entrepreneurship for young adults, and young adults, especially in other places around the world, are the people who need entrepreneurship the most and who actually need ways of supporting themselves and kind of like learning how to work out in the world in this. That's why I kind of think Roadie's pretty cool. Maybe I'll have to try it out one day. But I know Tony's been recently tinkering with a Raspberry Pi, and I'd love to hear sort of about your experience of that, Tony, as sort of your experience with open source hardware.
Fun as hell. Really fun to tinker with. There's so many different things that you can do with it. And, you know, I think through Adafruit, I think at about $50 I got hooked up with the Raspberry Pi itself, which I got the B plus. I got the B plus, not the newest one, but the one right before this. I got a case and a Wi-Fi dongle thing that works pretty well with it. And, you know, it runs off an SD card. And I'm sure by now everyone's kind of heard the Raspberry Pi train has taken off, but the reason it has so much hype is because of how cool it is and how many things you can do with it. I was playing around with, there's multiple operating systems you can install right off the bat from the installation of zip file that they give you when you download from the Raspberry Pi website. And you could play with all of them. There's a new version of Xbox or XBMC. I'm old, so I call it Xbox Media Center still, but it's XBMC. Now they're calling it Kodi with a K. So it kind of can replace all of your Media Center operations, although it's not as slick as Roku. I'm a big Roku fan, so it's not as slick as that, but it's infinitely more customizable. If you want to have a home server with properly tagged items and you know, scrobbling, there's really no better way to go. So for $50, I've tinkered and tinkered, and I plan to tinker a lot more. Overclocked it already. I have it hooked up to, I think I got about a 900 megahertz, I think I hooked it up to, because I don't have a great heat sink on it. I can't say enough, if you just want to learn about how hardware works, and software for that matter, and Linux. Like, let's say you want to play around and you want to learn a Linux distribution without spending a lot of money. For under $50, here you go, you know, and you just hook it up to your TV, and you'll need an SD card, and our micro SD card, and that's about it. I know there's a lot of people that are using them for cold storage. I know there's a lot of people that are using them to run a full node. I know there's a lot of people doing many multiple things involving Bitcoin with them, but I also think that in general, these are such a good way for anyone to really learn more about what's actually happening when they use their computer, because if you have a MacBook or if you have a Windows Surface, you turn it on and it works, right? You're not seeing the guts of it. You're not seeing what does what. What's this chip for? What does this do? You know, and I'm talking about for the beginners, not for people that know a little bit about it. Here, you really get to see everything and what it is, and you can kind of, you know, go online and see breakdowns of what this part is versus what this part is, why you need this, why you don't need this. Awesome. It's such a cool learning tool. I recommend anyone who's even remotely into computers to pick one up for $35. You'll have a ton of fun with it if you like tinkering around. You'll screw it up 10 times, but it doesn't matter because you can easily fix it because everything's just on an SD card. You know, unless you overclock it and it, you know, burns, that's the only thing that you can really do to mess it up permanently that I've seen. Well, obviously there's other things, but, you know, that's easy to mess up. So I would highly recommend it for everyone else, and I'm going to continue to play with it and see what other stuff I can get running on it, and, you know, see. My goal is to get 4K video off of it, but I doubt that's going to happen, but, you know, you got to set goals, right?
Well, the reason something like Raspberry Pi is really interesting to me, and I've not had the pleasure of working with one myself, is that it sort of engages both my paranoid and my curious side. So on the paranoid side, obviously, Raspberry Pi is of great use as being for cold storage of Bitcoin. And in general, I'm not going, I use closed source hardware, but I don't ultimately trust it at a really base primal level. But and on the other end of that, it just really engages my curiosity. Because my experience with technology and like getting to actually know it and emerging from that experience of sort of using it to understanding it has been entirely through tinkering. I've not like sat down and read a manual of this is decentralized technology. It's more like using it and trying to understand it and trying to see why knowing it's so important. And I really look forward to actually trying this out myself one day.
You know what's really cool to me about all of this, the Raspberry Pi and, you know, just in general, the maker movement has seen a major resurgence in the past 5 years, I would say. And there's a lot more things out there other than the Raspberry Pi. There's the Arduino, there's Intel has made a new entrance into this market. And it's really inspired a lot of these, you know, creative hackers to start building cool, tiny little projects, right, that have gained a little momentum. And some of them have even started to, you know, build businesses because they've found a viable business solution. And we're starting to see a restoration of what I call, it's actually a new market. I'm going to call it edge computing, where, you know, traditionally computing really started as sort of a centralized, like with central computers for computing, you know, the ballistics of a shell, right, to land on target, and that was a large amount of calculations that needed to be run, and then they automated this with you know, more electronic components, and then the mainframe industry through International Business Machines, IBM, sort of grew, and eventually it became, you know, spread out enough. We had this thing called a thin client where you could. You have a, you know, a basic terminal that would connect to the central mainframe. And then followed, you know, accessible computers for businesses rather than having to get a mainframe. You could have a computer in your business. And then personal computing became a thing. And then, you know, mobile devices became a thing. And now we're at this cusp of, you know, the deploying, this spreading out of computing power and resources to, like, the very fringes of the network, I'll say, this global intellectual network that is, you know, people, things, and some people are calling this the Internet of Things. You know, if you can imagine, you know, every light being a computing device that costs, you know, $2, right? There's a computing device in your light, your little lamp that sits on your desk that costs $2. There's a lot of things that you can do with that, not only just monitor electricity use, but it can become a smart device that learns to turn itself on and off, that just learns to interact with its surroundings much more intelligently than a device might be. And I think this is really exciting because there's going to be a lot less centralization in companies trying to provide services and products that explicitly do this. And it's gonna actually bake them into the things that we own. And that's going to be really exciting because now we have this true grid, a true mesh of computing fabric, right? If you look at, like, you know, all of the things in whatever room you're listening to this podcast in or even in your car, if you imagine your stereo being its own self-managing entity, if you manage your, you know, the steering system being a self-managing entity, or, you know, everything in the car, everything in the room you're in being a self-managing entity. There's a lot of really cool things, and the frustrations that a lot of people have of dealing with technology and how to figure out how to use your phone to do X, Y, or Z, or sometimes, you know, Z prime or A, B, and C. And it becomes more natural because things are just sort of natural and inherent. It becomes a much more natural interface, and that's something I'm really excited for.
I'm absolutely excited for it too, and it's really epic to see the kind of changes that are happening, the sort of ground shift that's occurring toward these kinds of experiences of technology. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that maybe in our culture, maybe for humans in general, we're just really fascinated with exploration. For instance, in this show, we're interviewing Jeff Garzik, who is a space entrepreneur in addition to his basically the work he does with Bitcoin Core. And I'm kind of geeking out about that, really excited about it, and really excited about sharing that with our listeners. But what is your experience of space? I mean, is space something that's fascinated you and that's been a big part of your kind of growth as a technologist or as a kind of an explorer of decentralized things?
Yeah. So when I was younger, I wanted to go, I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to be many things. But an astronaut was certainly one of the things that came up on a fairly regular basis. For the day, I want to be an astronaut. But it really drove me to learn about a lot of chemistry aspects, engineering aspects, and it pushed me, because I wanted to learn about all these things, and I read science fiction growing up, you know, My dad had me watch Star Wars when I was very young. It really just fascinated me, this concept, as Carl Sagan would put it, the pale blue dot. We are really ultimately, in all of these amazing things that we talk about on a regular basis, you know, the masses society, intelligent things that have come up with, Bitcoin being one of them, decentralized marketplaces being another, like this is some fascinating stuff. But when you sit down and think about it, we really are nothing in comparison to the massive, you know, stars and galaxies and, you know, the universe beyond, right? If you think about it, I mean, you start looking at things like the Drake equation, which is a loose calculation of how many intelligent societies exist out there based on our previous observations. It's not unlikely to suggest that we're just a thin piece of dust, a smudge on the galactic record book that means nothing in the greater scheme of things. And it really inspired me to discover what I call what's called transhumanism. And because if I, as a that, you know, 8 or 9 year old kid who is reading about, you know, the Apollo program and the von Neumann equations and trying to figure out, like, well, I want to go explore that. I want to get off of Earth, and I want to go to the moon. I want to go to Mars. I want to go explore Europa. I want to, you know, check out the rings of Saturn on my own, like, in person. I want to look out the window and look at them. And then what's beyond the solar system? And you start, and all of the billions and upon billions of other stars and things that are out there, there is just... It's impossible, unless we have some major technological advancement, it's going to be impossible for any of us to do these things. And it was that realization that brought me to think about, you know, transhumanism, and, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to extend life. And that really drove me very deeply into my interest in technology. And I don't know if it's ever going to be possible, but I'll be damned if I don't at least try to make as many of these things possible in my lifetime as I can. And that's my motivation every single day.
I'm definitely with you on the transhumanism part. I never grew up like being amazed by space. Obviously, I thought it was always cool, but it wasn't something where I was like, I want to go out there. It was more like, you know, I had other interests. But the older I get, the more interesting I do think it is. I think it's important for many reasons to you know, obviously explore it. But I think it's something where we're in a unique time because we're finally seeing the privatization of the space industry. So let's see where this takes us, right? Let's see how far we can go here and what we can get to. Let's see if you know, by the time you're, you know, 513, Eric, because we will have extended life that far, you'll be able to, you know, glide by the rings of Saturn and say, hey, I thought I'd see this someday, and now I did. We don't know, but I do think it's cool that we're working toward it, and we all should anyways, because what's the worst that's going to happen, right? And so I think as far as space goes, I'm not one of those people that was a dreamer that was, you know, like, oh, that this is all the awe and the wonder in the world. No, I when I was a kid, I liked baseball cards and video games. But now that I'm older, I do appreciate it a lot more. And I think that things like what Jeff's going to be talking about with BitSat is going to be very interesting, very interesting.
Absolutely. That's kind of the inspiring thing about it. Like Eric was saying, we may be a small speck, but we can take that as a challenge. And I think Jeff's taking that as a challenge. Elon Musk is taking that as a challenge. And increasingly, we can all take that as a challenge. So we will move on to that and talk to Jeff about what he's building. But until then, until next week, listeners, you can find us on decentralized.fm, listen to all past episodes of the show, listen to Torrents. But absolutely enjoy the coming interview with Jeff Garzik of Dunvegan Space Systems, BitPay, and Bitcoin Core.
Today we're joined by Jeff Garzik, Bitcoin Core developer and the founder and CEO of Dunvegan Space Systems, which is working on the BitSat project, deploying Bitcoin full nodes into orbit via satellite. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on Decentralize.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background prior to getting involved with Bitcoin and BitPay and all of these fantastic projects? Where did you come from? I believe you came from Red Hat. Tell us a little bit about your experience there.
Yeah, hailing from North Carolina and open source is really my background. I've been in open source for more than two decades. And starting out at Georgia Tech and just being able to dabble with any sort of software package that you could download off the internet, that was really just the most amazing experience. Jumping on the internet in the late 1980s, that was before the web, actually. I had the experience of being able to access this entire global village. You know, that was way before Tim Berners-Lee invented HTTP, etc., but the beginnings were there. It was really an introduction to a global network and teaching me at an early age how to be a global network citizen. And from there, the next introduction was open source. Anyone who was on the internet in those days or its predecessor network, Usenet, which is interestingly quite a bit similar to how Bitcoin sends its transactions around the world. Internet and Usenet had a culture of sharing source code. And that culture of sharing source code really had existed from the very earliest days of the internet through 1992, which is sort of when my experience with it starts. And from there, sharing source code really snowballed into what became the open source movement. And just as I was working as a programmer and system administrator at a local Atlanta dental practice, area, it was a very interesting experience to submit source code changes, source code patches to Linus Torvalds, and actually have them accept them. I was I was amazed to be able to change this Linux operating system that someone had posted to the internet way over in the University of Helsinki in Finland, and to actually have my changes accepted really stoked the developer enthusiasm in me. And I kept submitting changes, and of course, the way open source works, at least in those days, they would give you feedback. They would say, nope, that is completely unacceptable, and here's why. And that's key to the open source process as well, is feedback. And so you'd receive feedback from Linus and these other very smart developers, and that really became an excellent tutelage or mentoring into open source. So I spent the next 10 years doing that, is throwing spaghetti at a wall, as we called it, submitting source code changes to Linus, seeing what source code changes would be accepted, which would not, and really working with the community to find out how they want their software developed. That's what I love about open source, is just a rapid interaction with the community members, a rapid back and forth, and the open source community is a very vital and vocal community, and they'll let you know if you're going astray. So that's it's sort of a open source trial by fire, and that was an excellent introduction into the Bitcoin open source community, which is very vocal and energetic and young and disruptive as well.
So, Jeff, can you tell us about how you first heard about Bitcoin and how you went from just hearing about it to being so deeply involved in the project?
Well, it was quite similar to my Linux background, interestingly enough. I first heard about Bitcoin in July of 2010 and the great slash dotting of Bitcoin, and that was the first wide coverage of Bitcoin that Slashdot, a news for nerds site that's widely read, published a story on Bitcoin. That was where Jed McCaleb of Mt. Gox and Ripple fame first heard about Bitcoin. That's where I first heard about Bitcoin. Many of our longtime community members found out about Bitcoin through that. And from there, it was, just like Linux, an open source project. Bitcoin absolutely requires that all source code be public and open to inspection. Otherwise, you can't trust it with money. And so it was a natural fit, just like Linux, to any open source developer. I downloaded the source code, which is just, it, as a programmer, it's just amazing to be able to peek under the hood, to look at revolutionary software, understand how it works. There are no secrets in open source software, and that's really what attracted me to Bitcoin as well. So you can download open source software if you're a programmer. You can study it, modify it, and here's the key is you submit changes back to the original developers. In my case, this was Satoshi himself. Satoshi Nakamoto was the original open source project leader for Bitcoin. And in those days, very similar to how Linux used to run Linux, is it was the throw spaghetti at a wall method of submitting changes. You'd submit a source code change. Satoshi may or may not respond to your source code changes. If he does, you may or may not get feedback. It may or may not appear. It was a very chaotic early type of process. Thankfully, Satoshi recognized this early on, and he brought in Gavin Andreessen, who was at that time in July of 2010, a regular source code contributor. And Gavin really understood the open source development process and was a great help in just interfacing with the community. And I think he was a little bit better of a project leader than Satoshi was himself. Satoshi was absolutely a great designer, but not necessarily the best coder or open source project leader. So getting involved in July of 2010 mainly involved, I saw some source code, I downloaded it. As many other programmers, I started playing with it, writing my own modifications. And in particular, on the mining side, on the Bitcoin mining side, I started writing some small changes, and I wrote the first CPU miner for Bitcoin that was external to Bitcoin itself. And so that really opened up the race for CPU mining. Then, as we all know, it was followed by GPU mining, FPGA, etc. And that was the first external miner for Bitcoin. And that was the first change that Satoshi accepted into the Bitcoin software from me, was enabling that external mining. So in my own small way, I set off the ASIC mining race, if you want to project 3 or 4 years ahead.
And with that said, I had a quick question on the history of Bitcoin regarding from 2010 until now, since you've been, you know, a part of the scene since then. How do you see the development coming along compared to what you saw with Linux when you were a contributor to Linux?
Well, Linux really had a, that's a good question, and I get that pretty frequently. Linux really had a much more mature developer ecosystem. When I was involved in it, I was sort of, to make an analogy, I was sort of like a team leader. The word we used was maintainer, and I would have 10 to 12 developers submitting changes to me, and I would review those, test those, and then send those in turn to Linus himself. And so it's sort of like an upward flowing pyramid of changes where you have literally hundreds, perhaps thousand developers all working on the same source code base, the Linux kernel. And with Bitcoin, we just don't have that number of developers yet. And that's one of the things that I would really like to improve upon and change about the Bitcoin community is growing new developers. It is absolutely critical that we teach new developers about the Bitcoin protocol, how Bitcoin works, how cryptocurrencies secure funds, how they transfer value, how you can write hash protocols that introduce trustless features into money. All of those things are very new concepts to both economic specialists, computer science specialists. Pick your specialty. It's really a brand new economy, a brand new knowledge base for people to learn. And as a result, if you haven't been involved in Bitcoin for years and years and been soaking this up, then you just have a big knowledge gap, a big learning curve to mount. And any sort of educational acceleration that I can make happen, I'm definitely pursuing. And so education in 2015 for Bitcoin developers is definitely one of my priorities.
So you've been doing a lot of interesting work. I know BitPay employs you to basically help contribute to Bitcoin Core. There's been a couple of interesting projects come out of this, and one that comes to mind in particular is the Impulse Zero Confirmation Network. Would you mind describing that and describing the need for that, and what other types of things would you like to see in the future be added?
Well, ultimately, the motivation behind the Impulse protocol was that the holy grail for Bitcoin is really instant payments. Bitcoin, as the lowest layer is currently designed now, the blockchain, it is more, as I term it, a settlement system. When you send someone bitcoins, it is not confirmed into the blockchain until a miner has validated that transaction, stored it in a block. And then from that, it is not yet secure until other miners have built upon that with other Bitcoin blocks. We call that being buried in the chain or having a certain number of confirmations for your transaction. And so from there, that takes a lot of time, and obviously that doesn't necessarily fit the brick-and-mortar payment type model where you go into a Starbucks and you buy a coffee, or you're shopping online and you want instant feedback for your purchase. Excuse me. And so the holy grail of a Bitcoin payment is something that is secure and instant. And so right now we have one or the other, where if we have an instant payment, then it's an unconfirmed transaction and it's not really that secure. Or we have a secure payment and you've waited for confirmations, but it's not instant. How to bridge that gap? Well, there's an interesting technology called payment channels, which can be used to bridge that gap. The key, unfortunately, is that we need to upgrade the wallet software to support payment channels. So the current Bitcoin wallet ecosystem does not support that. That said, once upgraded, this payment channel technology can enable many, many new use cases for Bitcoin that are currently not widely deployed now. Notably, instant transactions. So instant transactions really uses this payment channel feature to do something interesting. The way payment channels work, to provide a little bit of background, is that you first embed some funds onto the blockchain while also creating an avenue for a refund. And once you've done that, you set up a multi-sig negotiation with another party who's going to help you facilitate your payment. This is getting a bit technical for some of the listeners, but ultimately you're creating a multi-sig agreement to pay, and once you create that agreement, you embed funds in the blockchain. Once you've embedded funds in the blockchain, you guarantee that you're not going to double spend those funds away, and you can then use those funds for instant payments to Starbucks, to Uber, to pick your use case. So payment channels really enable that specific use case, and Impulse is built upon payment channels itself. So have we achieved the holy grail of instant secure payments? Well, I'd say that gets us maybe 90-95% there. Really, we're going to have to build some future layers into the protocol to enable all of the use cases that we want, both instant payment and not. But Impulse is really a big step forward towards that holy grail of instant payments.
It's absolutely fascinating. What other projects do you see out there similar to Impulse that you see as being as building on your work with Bitcoin that you like, or proposals for the improvement of Bitcoin that you'd like to see implemented?
Well, I'm very excited about one improvement in particular. This requires an update to the network policy rules. That's called a soft fork. And this feature is called, the technical name for it is op check lock time verify, which is a bunch of technical gobbledygook for being able to embed a transaction onto the Bitcoin blockchain. And here's the key. It is impossible to spend that transaction until a certain time in the future. Now, what this primitive or what this feature does is it enables all sorts of protocols where you can commit funds to a certain transaction, to a certain effort. You're essentially making a promise and backing it with very real money. And you're locking up that money on the Bitcoin blockchain such that you're provably not going to be spending that funds for any other purpose whatsoever. And you can use that primitive to build refund transactions in multi-party scenarios. You can use that feature for many, many use cases where you can add some safety to the negotiation. You provably establish that funds are available, and you do that with the sort of the gold standard of proof in our community, which is publish it to the Bitcoin blockchain. So that's really exciting, but it also takes a majority of miners to agree to upgrade to this this new feature because, as I said, it's a soft fork, which is an upgrade to the network policy rules.
That's excellent. That's really exciting to hear. I think that there would be a lot of benefits to the sort of more widespread adoption of Bitcoin if we start seeing those types of things deployed. So I want to kind of transition. So Dunvegan's space. I was first introduced to this through the BitSat project, and you've recently sort of refocused your efforts on this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your impetus for getting this project off the ground? And where are you going with this, Jeff?
Well, thanks for asking. I'm very excited about this new project. The genesis was, again, in the Bitcoin community itself. Basically, my hosts are trying to distract me here. The genesis is really in the Bitcoin community, increasing Bitcoin's resilience. I was thinking about many of the ways that we can increase Bitcoin's resilience. And one of the ways is alternate Bitcoin blockchain distribution. So the any number of ways to, the technical term for it is spread or decrease the attack surface on Bitcoin is something that we can use to improve Bitcoin security. And specifically, if we can store the blockchain on other mediums that, thinking terrestrially, for example, we could store the blockchain on Amazon S3, we could store it on BitTorrent, as we already do, and all of these other mechanisms provide a backup in case the primary Bitcoin network is being attacked, is being DDoSed, etc. You still have a source of blocks. Now, you take that idea and you follow it to its logical conclusion. What is the absolute best way to get Bitcoin blocks? And that's really get them from space. From the standpoint of blockchain distribution, if you have a satellite that has the entire blockchain up in space, you don't have to worry about your satellite getting DDoSed. You don't have to worry about your satellite getting physically attacked. Unless you're the U.S. or China, et cetera. But for all practical purposes, once the satellite is up there, it's up there. And that was really attractive for the blockchain. But as I developed the idea and developed a network of satellites that would broadcast a blockchain all over the globe, it was clear that this satellite was so much more than just for Bitcoin. It was really a worldwide communications platform, a worldwide data broadcast and data processing platform. And so that's really what made me take the plunge into starting my own company, is that it was such a powerful idea, giving not just the Bitcoin community access to space, but finding some way to give everyone on Earth access to space. And that's really the promise of sort of the cloud as we see it on Earth, you know, cloud computing, cloud technology. And what can we do to extend that to space? Imagine if you could provide anyone on Earth, assuming that they're a developer, with an API that allows them direct access to a satellite, to store data on the satellite, to upload new applications. In this case, you can upload your own BitcoinD, your own Bitcoin node, or if you have an encrypted message project, you can upload that. If you have a Bitcoin Oracle, which is a sort of a bot-type piece of software which processes Bitcoin value transfer requests and evaluates them autonomously, you can upload that to the satellite and execute it. So it was really a software as a service platform that was born out of this very interesting resilience project for Bitcoin. So you can imagine any number of applications on the satellite which involve looking at the blockchain, introspecting the blockchain, or just using the extra bandwidth and extra processing power on the satellite for data vault applications, for additional cryptocurrency processing. Yes, if you have an alternate chain or a side chain, we will support that as well. You know, we're open to all customers, even Dogecoin customers. If they can afford to put it on satellite, we'd be happy to have them. But it was really resilience morphed into this very interesting data processing platform that we hope to make available to everyone in the entire world.
That's really interesting, Jeff. I think it's going to be really important to go ahead and do this. Talk to us a little bit about your long-term vision. Like, what does a world look like when we have this sort of purely decentralized network that's accessible via space, it's accessible to everyone? And how does the sort of open source philosophy apply to, you know, what your vision of the future is?
Absolutely. It's just like Bitcoin, just like with Linux, it's key to have an open platform. And what that means specifically is that customers deserve to be able to look under the hood to know what they are getting. With how that translates to Dunvegan Space is that we're going to be publishing the BitSat design that aerospace engineers can actually look through, and they can see what parts are on our satellite, how it's designed, what is the power budget, which is the term for how much power our satellite uses, what is the mass budget, which is the term for how much each of the parts on the satellite weigh. And those sorts of things are very critical to spacecraft development. For example, the weight issue, every additional gram of weight translates to dollars at launch. And to throw some figures out at your listeners, our spacecraft, it's a 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter by 30 centimeter CubeSat. And so it's pretty small, but it takes, based on weight, if it's a 10 kilogram weight, $300,000 to get that up into low Earth orbit. So that's a lot of money to you and me, but in terms of overall space costs over the decades, that's the cheapest that launches have ever been. And so it really introduces new business models. It makes space more accessible to more people around the world. And I think that that cost shift, that cost decrease, has really opened up space to so many more people, so many more businesses. So the long-term vision is really provide a open platform where everyone is aware of our capabilities, our rough costs, our resilience factors, etc. And from there, they can really build their own platforms, their own space startups on top of our platform, just like people build websites on top of Rackspace or Amazon. You know, we'll really be sort of a Rackspace in space.
As a follow-up to that, I know that you are going to be involved with South by Southwest coming up. Can you talk a little bit about what your involvement is there before we leave?
Absolutely. It's we're really excited about South by Southwest. It's going to be a fantastic opportunity for Dunvegan Space. We're really having, I'd call it a coming out party for Dunvegan at South by. We have a panel where we're talking about big data in the cloud, and that really fits with our BitSat vision of a cheap, decentralized platform in space. Because, and this is another key, is we're really bringing decentralized principles from Bitcoin into space. We don't just have one satellite or two satellites. We're going to have a constellation of 24 satellites. And just like a Bitcoin node can fail and Bitcoin keeps going, we can have a satellite fail and the satellite constellation keeps going. That's key to the many cheap, decentralized type approach that many of these modern technologies, both in space and on the ground, are taking.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jeff. I know our listeners can find you on Twitter at jgarzik. They can follow Dunvegan Space and all the exciting things you're doing there at dunveganspace.com and at Dunvegan Space. Also see a lot of your work at BitPay. But are there any other projects you have coming up or websites or things you'd like to highlight where people can find all the interesting things you're doing?
Well, I'd love for people to visit dunveganspace.com and see sort of our long-term vision for where we want to go in the next couple decades. The satellite constellation is really the first step into space. And long-term, we look at a strategy of Bitcoin and financial technologies as really being the foundation for space exploration. You can introduce Bitcoin into the spaceflight ecosystem, and you suddenly have space vendors, notably our vendors, accepting Bitcoin for spacecraft. Or you see with BitPay, BitPay accepts Bitcoin on behalf of Virgin Galactic, who is one of their merchants, for space flights. And so this is just another example of how Bitcoin and financial technology are making inroads into specific, very, very new industries and disrupting them as well. It's a very exciting time in space, and it's a very exciting time in Bitcoin.
This is amazing. I think I can speak on behalf of us and all of our listeners when we say we wish you the best of luck in taking Bitcoin literally to the moon, perhaps beyond it. So best of luck at South by Southwest, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.